Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. As I was walking away from the Parimutuel window the other day, I was thinking about some of my favorite stories of 2011, which include a visit with the Harlem Globetrotters, a conversation with former Laotian refugee and poker champion Jerry Yang, and the ill-fated campaign of the soccer writer who wanted to be the president of FIFA. Also ahead, Atlanta's beloved holiday tradition, the Gingerbread Trailer Park Contest.
It is a lovely subdivision of two trailers. We've got some mock inflatable snowmen and gingerbread men. We do have shoes hanging from the telephone wire and the requisite tires that line the path. We're going to win. We're confident.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals worldwide. Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. On an early spring afternoon at Harvard University's Malkin Athletic Center, everybody was feeling fine. That was because the guy asking was one of the Harlem Globetrotters, and most of the rest of the people in the building were students at the nearby Martin Luther King Elementary and Middle School. The kids couldn't wait to see the Globetrotters perform their sleight of hand and foot and head with the basketball. But first, there were more serious matters to consider.
Healthy mind and body. Everybody say healthy mind and body.
Since 2004, various and numerous manifestations of the Globetrotters have had a mission beyond showmanship. They've brought the children a program the Globies call Cheer. The letters in that word stand for character, healthy mind and body, effort, enthusiasm, and responsibility. On the day I attended, the Globies picked four children and one teacher to step down out of the bleacher and define those words. After which, everybody clapped, and the four lucky children and their teacher formed an amateur version of the Globetrotters' famous magic circle. The magic circle, as performed by the pros, was as impressive as it has been for the past 85 years. And the kids enjoyed it, much as their parents and grandparents had enjoyed it when Meadowlark Lemon and Goose Tatum were still clowning. Though I can't remember either of them doing backwards handsprings.
Yes, I really liked it. And I like them because that flip, I like it.
That's Destiny, who's in the first grade. Her mom, Lydia Wharton, probably enjoyed the flip too, though she also noted the benefits of the cheer program.
It was an educational thing for the kids. I think that, you know, what they learn, hopefully it'll help them, you know, be more into going to school and have that education and look forward to it.
Annalise Aminoff was another of the youngsters with a parent in tow. She provided evidence that for a 7-year-old, even the oldest basketball trick in the book can seem new.
Yeah, I really, really want to spin a basketball on my finger.
What do you think, Dad? You going to be ready to help her learn that?
I'm not sure that's my skill set, but I'll try.
Responsibility, thy name is helping your daughter learn to spin a basketball on her finger, or something like that. As the kids gathered around the Globetrotters to get autographs at the end of the program, Anthony Blakes, a.k.a. Buckets, explained why he and his teammates focused on character, the first concern of the cheer program.
You can be the most talented, the most popular, the smartest kid in class, but without character, none of that matters. So that's what this is all about, trying to make sure that these kids know that character can take them a long way in life.
Buckets has been a Globetrotter since 2002, and he's also an ambassador for cheer. He has no doubt that the program is working.
When you look at these kids, you can see them engaged in what we're saying and that it's something simple to remember for them as well. And not only that, you know, they get to have a little fun at the same time. So it's not just us coming in with a speech about character. We also involve the kids by letting them do a little ball handling as well as pulling out a teacher. You know, sometimes the kids need to see the teachers having fun.
And sometimes they have to see the teachers trying to dance, which puts the teachers in exactly the spot the kids would like to see them.
Exactly. They got to know that their teachers are human beings and vulnerable, too, and they're not spooky. You can go talk to them anytime you want to. So we pull a teacher out and get them to dance and do some tricks with the basketball, and that's what it's all about. We're all human beings here. We just want to be the best human beings we can possibly be each and every day.
The Globetrotters proudly consider themselves role models, but anybody familiar with the history of this team, which travels with a personal patsy squad, the Washington Generals, knows the Trotters are never defeated. So I asked Buckets Blakes how he and his teammates could teach children what it means to lose with grace.
You know what? We don't know how to lose. I've never lost a game since I've been on the Harlem Globetrotters.
This astonishes me.
You know, this is my ninth season, and you know, I've lost in college. I lost on other professional teams. But going 9 years without a loss, I mean, I don't even know what does that look like? What does it feel like? Does it smell?
One of the other Globetrotters, Nate Big Easy Lofton, overheard that last business. And when he'd completed the autograph he was in the process of signing, he offered some of his thoughts about the unimaginable losing.
Well, the Globetrotters are winners. But the last time we lost was in 1971. And I was born in 1981, so I had nothing to do with that.
So the cheer program does not talk about accepting defeat with equanimity. But Buckets and Big Easy and the rest of the Trotters at Harvard on Monday made a good case for the rest of the components of cheer, and they made lots of young friends as well.
We sign autographs for 30 minutes after every game, and then these kids will walk up to you after the game asking for an autograph and like, hey, you came to my school last year and you talked about cheer. So, you know, that gives you the chills, you know, like you actually got through. And our whole point is, if we've only touched, you know, five or six children out of these 150, 200 kids, we've done our job for the day, because those five or six children will be our messengers for the rest of the time when we're not around.
Can I get a shot?
Over the coming year, members of the Harlem Globetrotters will be delighting and inspiring children of all ages from Anchorage to Zurich. At an in-town Atlanta bar, an unusual competition has gained traction as a holiday favorite. Participants say it's an event with more sugar than the Sugar Bowl and even more festivity than the Fiesta Bowl. In 2010, reporter Philip Gratzer attended the fourth annual Gingerbread Trailer Park Contest, and he had this report.
Chantel Ritter got the idea for Gingerbread Trailers when she visited New Orleans a few years back and saw FEMA trailers decorated for Christmas. She figured the trailer motif was ripe for Christmas exploitation.
I thought that gingerbread shouldn't be limited to Victorians and little cabins, when in fact trailer parks are one of the most decorative Christmas things you see.
The design and decorating contest has only a few rules. The trailer park has to fit on a lot the size of a case of beer. Ingredients other than gingerbread can be used, but the entry has to be 90% edible. And no meat is allowed.
But changing the building thing to like no gingerbread required just really turns it on its head, where they can build with sugar wafers and pretzels and like crazy stuff.
Tonight at the Euclid Avenue Yacht Club, a bar 250 miles away from the Atlantic Ocean, competitors, dressed in Santa's helper suits and hats or their finest Happy Birthday Jesus t-shirts, are pimping their entries for the crowd. Cresta Schaefer just moved to Atlanta.
I just think it's a very fun twist on a Christmas classic. We're the ho-ho hoarders, so we've got our trailer and our little white trash couple and lots of piles of trash around the place. We're winning.
She and four of her friends spent several sober days building their trailer park.
Honestly, there was no drinking involved. We just have messed up minds.
Although a few of the trailer parks are Christmassy cute, Jolene Beckett knows that to win in this sport, you have to be more naughty than nice.
Our exhibit is Loretta Mae Sanders Trailer Park.
And it is a lovely subdivision of two trailers, and it is lit up with gorgeous sparkling lights. We've got some mock inflatable snowmen and gingerbread men, a couple of dogs in the yard, and one very large orange marzipan cat peering down over everyone. We do have shoes hanging from the telephone wire and the requisite tires that line the path. We're going to win. We're confident.
She tells me how she made the tires.
Those are cut in half Entenmann's chocolate donuts. We ate a lot of them, too. They're really tasty.
There are R and even X-rated trailer parks. A trailer park called Payday at the North Pole features a reindeer stripper and a drunken Santa passed out in yellow snow. Cameron Ayers recreated a local icon.
Ours is the Starlight Drive-In. Have a Christmas Story playing in the background. Have the light-up sign. Have Palookaville, that is a local guy that sells corn dogs at the drive-in.
Gingerbread, fondant, poppy seeds, and royal icing are the building materials for this model of the last drive-in theater in Atlanta. Like most sports, a key to winning is catching your opponent off guard. That means coming up with a new way to build. One past winner used blue jello for an above-ground swimming pool. This year, there's a trailer built of matzah. According to Ayers, the game plan is a secret.
No one knows what you're doing until you show up here. You don't let on any secrets, no trade techniques, nothing. It's all very secretive and find out different ingredients to use, what works best, different techniques. But no, you don't tell them before the competition.
There's a cash prize for the most creative, unique, and Christmassy entry. But Ayers says it's not about the money.
You want to win. It's bragging rights. I don't care about the prize. I want to say I was better than his was. And it's the competitiveness. It's just your nature of the sport.
This year's celebrity judge, a local top chef, didn't show. So there were just two judges, a sculptor and Deborah Vallée, a former trailer park winner. Vallée is judged for life because she first brought blue jello swimming pools to the competition. Finally, organizer Chantel Ritter stands on a table and announces the winners.
Honorable mention number three is lot number seven, Loretta May. Oh.
Jolene Beckett's victory speech isn't humble.
We labored with love and a lot of fondant and marzipan and candied whatnots. Threw it all together, and now it is the most amazing redneck vision of Christmas loveliness that you have ever seen.
Cameron Ayers gets second place for his drive-in theater.
And for first place, for $100, is lot number eight for Jill.
The loser's disappointment is palpable, but there's always next year. For Only a Game, I'm Philip Gratzer in Atlanta.
The fifth annual Gingerbread Trailer Park Contest took place on December 11, 2011 at Atlanta's Euclid Avenue Yacht Club. The third place winner was titled Quickie Mart. A trailer with a vaguely Darwinian theme took second, and the first place winner, titled The Real Walking Dead Housewives, featured a very naughty Santa, a zombie, and a pretzel deer. More I cannot tell you.
You're kind of naughty, but you're naughty and nice. Gingerbread, 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 gingerbread. You're full of sugar, you're full of spice. You're kind of naughty, but you're naughty and nice.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. It may be Doga, or it may be Doga, but it started in Florida, and long may it thrive. We're talking yoga for people and their dogs. When you feel good, they feel good. According to Susie Teitelman, who leads the yoga classes, they want to be around your goodness. We chant together to feel the vibrations, and then we start moving into twists and turns. Do the dogs enjoy these gyrations? Ms. Teitelman says they do. They're getting touched, they're getting loved, and everybody needs to be hanging upside down. Nor does Ms. Teitelman think the benefits are limited to dogs. She has said that the classes work for cats, and once, when she was doing downward dog, her bird came over to investigate. I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, World Series of Poker champion Jerry Yang recounts his childhood and his poker career. But first, the proliferation of sports replay and review technology is delivering more sports information than ever to viewers, and as Only a Game's Doug Trabu originally reported in June of 2011, there's even more minutia to come.
For the past decade or so, Major League Baseball telecasts have included replays of pitches with the strike zone superimposed. But in 2011, for the first time, ESPN placed the box over the catcher during some at-bats while they were being shown live. SportVision created K-Zone and supplies similar technology to other television networks. SportVision president and COO Mike Jacob says how often K-Zone appears during live action is ESPN's editorial decision.
There's still some experimenting going on, trying to figure out what's the optimal mix. But for a particular at-bat where you're expecting a kind of a pitcher-batter duel, it is interesting to see how the pitcher's working that batter over the course of the at-bat.
New York Post sports columnist Phil Mushnick says with the score, pitch speed, players' names, stats, and sports news already on the screen, he can do without another visual.
It's a distraction. I mean, it's a toy. Did you ever walk in drunk to a McDonald's at 3 in the morning and look at the overhead menu and everything starts swimming around as all this information and you don't know a number 5 and a 6 for $2.99? It's like that.
K-Zone may be partly television window dressing, but the technology behind it is data-driven. SportVision has tracked every major league pitch since 2007. Using three cameras, they calculate the trajectory 50 times between the pitcher's hand and home plate and adjust the strike zone for each batter. The company claims it's accurate to within an inch, and the league and its teams are more than willing to pay for that kind of data.
I love the human element. I don't know that umpires really should be a part of that.
That's SB Nation's national baseball editor, Rob Nyer, one of the moderators at this spring's MIT Sloan Sports Analytics Conference in Boston. Nyer says reviewing balls and strikes would be too time-consuming, but expanding replay is long overdue.
Look, my favorite team won a World Series because an umpire made a lousy call, the 1985 Royals. If I could go back and change that, would I? You know, I might. The Cardinals fans have a legitimate gripe. They probably should have won that game and the World Series if the call had been made correctly. Baseball would be better, I think, if that had not happened.
Baseball is currently using replay for close call home runs, and the new collective bargaining agreement will allow umps to review fair and foul ball calls and trapped ball catches in 2012. The NHL has reviewed goals for years. The NBA reviews three-pointers and buzzer beaters. Mike Pereira spent 9 years as the National Football League's vice president of officiating and now works as a rules analyst for Fox Sports. He believes review has improved the quality of NFL games.
And I so vividly remember a Thanksgiving Day game in Detroit where there were three on-field officiating errors that got corrected by replay. And the beauty of it was is that the next day in the paper, there was no mention about the fact that replay had corrected these errors or that the errors were made in the first place. The topic of conversation was about the football game and the players.
One of the most prominent sports video technologies is football's yellow first down line. It's also produced by SportVision and is so popular the company is working with NFL teams to include it in highlights shown in stadiums. Pereira likes the yellow line, but hopes it stays limited to televisions and jumbotrons.
You know, there are people that are out there with technology proposing a first down line, as you can see on television, and be able to put it actually on the field, projected on the field itself. The poor official now who has to make a spot and comes in and puts the ball down 1/16 of an inch short of this visible first down line is going to be accused of having been involved in a conspiracy.
Sports Illustrated senior writer L. John Wertheim co-authored a book called Scorecasting that analyzes blown calls and other factors that contribute to the outcomes of games. Last summer, Wertheim was in England covering Wimbledon. The tennis tournament uses Hawkeye technology, which involves several cameras and a complex algorithm to calculate whether balls are in or out.
The next day I watched this World Cup game between the UK and Germany, and there's this dispute over whether the UK scored a goal. And they ended up botching the call. It was a goal. It had crossed this line, and the officials thought it hadn't. And I was just marveling at how you have this huge sports property that's resisting technology, and sort of backwards conservative tennis is the head of the field.
However, Wertheim says the improved accuracy in tennis does come at a price.
Tennis had this history of these arguments and seeing players erupt over these botched line calls. John McEnroe is the great exponent. And I think it's a fair point that you've sort of bleached away some color when you've got this video board. I mean, the fans like seeing the replay, but the fans also like seeing these confrontations, and you don't really have too many of those now because you've got the right call with darn near precision.
All this talk about using technology to improve games and broadcasts got me thinking. I asked SportVision's Mike Jacob to explain which parts of a game translate to the best graphics for fans at home.
It has to be something that happens a lot, is hard to see, and has a meaningful impact on the outcome of the game.
Let's see. Something that happens a lot, is hard to see, and has a meaningful impact. That sounds like Bill's weekly conversation with Charlie Pierce. Maybe only a game should have its own audio reminder for listeners.
Charlie Pierce is coming up in 15 minutes and 10 seconds.
Perfect. Anyway, in sports, there's more technology coming.
Charlie Pierce is coming up in 15 minutes and 6 seconds.
Okay, our technology's probably not quite ready for prime time, but the next level of data gathering is already beginning in baseball. SportVision's Mike Jacob says his company's goal is a complete digital record of every game.
Knowing where every player is at every point in time, multiple times a second, as well as the referee and the ball.
In case you missed that, here's a low-tech instant replay.
Knowing where every player is at every point in time, multiple times a second, as well as the referee and the ball.
And Jacob says that kind of tracking will generate a lot of data.
Think of a steal play. We'll know how far the runner got off first base before the pitcher went into his motion. We'll know how far he advanced during the motion. We'll know, you know, how long did it take the catcher to get the ball out of the glove. How far did the shortstop have to run and how fast to get to second base. You know, what was the top speed of the run? I mean, there's just so much data that you can collect on every play.
SB Nation's Rob Nyer has a prediction about how all of this information will change things for fans at home.
Someday we're going to be able to sit in the middle of a room and have the field, the players be around us, 3D or whatever you want to call it. But there's no reason why with miniaturization of cameras and chips and all the other stuff, you couldn't do all of those things.
And while people like Scorecasting co-author John Wertheim are ready and waiting for the next deluge of sports information, he respects fans who already feel oversaturated.
There's definitely a segment that says, look, enough already. I don't need to know Derek Jeter's percentage on balls hit behind the pitcher's back on a rainy night in the Pacific time zone.
But if it happens to come up in conversation, someday soon you'll be able to find out. For Only a Game, I'm Doug Tribou.
As a child, Jerry Yang liked playing marbles. Since he and his fellow Laotians living in a Thai refugee camp during the 70s had no money to buy marbles, they made their own out of stones. As an adult, Jerry Yang discovered that he enjoyed playing poker, and just a few years later, he earned a seat at the final table at the World Series of Poker in Las Vegas, where millions of dollars can change hands on the turn of a card. In his book, All In, written with Mark Tabb, Jerry Yang describes his journey from Laos, which he fled with his family, to the top of the poker heap. In August of 2011, I asked Yang to tell the story of how he and his family left their home in Laos when he was only 7 years old.
The village that I lived in, we lived very close to the border of Vietnam, and I grew up in the war zone, and aside from that, I was always hungry, and my father fought along with the American soldiers during the Vietnam War. He was assigned to the Ho Chi Minh, the infamous Trail Ho Chi Minh. And not only my father, but many other villagers in my village and thousands of Hmong people. And I just want to correct you earlier. My nationality is actually Hmong, but we live in Laos. Mm-hmm. So they eventually invaded my country in the May of 1975. And my family had no choice but to escaped to our neighboring country, Thailand.
Your father's service was also, I gather, the reason that your family did eventually, after 4 years in the refugee camp in Thailand, make it to the United States.
That's correct, yes. We were given options to go to France, Canada, and to some other South American countries. But my father refused. And he said, you know, I fought along with those American soldiers. I put my life on the line. I want to go to America because I truly believe that only in America that I would be able to experience freedom and peace.
Now, interestingly enough, you write that for the first 30-plus years of your life, you never played a hand of cards. Why not?
I grew up, my father, to be honest with you, my father is a true disciplinarian. And I remember growing up, I was the most mischievous child in my family. And my father never allowed us to play chess or checkers because he thought that those games would lead us into gambling. And so we never had that opportunity at all.
What changed your mind about cards, or more specifically about poker?
I used to be a clinical psychologist, and having interviewed a lot of my clients throughout my career, I could tell when a client is lying to me or they're telling me the truth. And just based on their body gestures and the way they cross their legs and whether or not they purse their lips when they speak to me. So I use some of those at the poker table. And when I first discovered poker in 2005, it was November, and I remember sitting next to my wife on the sofa, and I saw poker for the very first time, and I knew that I could do it.
So this was when you were sitting on the sofa with your wife. You were watching poker on TV.
That's correct. Uh-huh.
This may be the greatest advertisement possible for televised poker, that they drew in a guy who eventually went on to be one of the most successful players in the world.
Yeah, and my wife had, if she had grabbed the remote control that night, I mean, we would be watching HGTV, you know. But, I mean, not to say anything bad about HGTV, I love that show, but that night would just happen to be my night. I just happened to grab the remote control first, and I switched it to channel 144 ESPN, and there it was, you know, the final table of the World Series of Poker.
Your wife was not enthusiastic about your new hobby when you told her that you thought this would be something you should get into. How did you convince her that you wouldn't be risking the family's security when you started playing poker?
Oh, goodness, Bill. That's the best part. I remember when I saw poker on TV, I pointed to the TV and I turned to her and I said, honey, I can do that. And when I win, I will use the money for good. And I remember she turned to me and she gave me this very, very disgusting look. And yeah, and Bill, you know, when you have six kids like me and a mortgage and a car payment, I don't blame her a bit. But I made a promise to her that I would take only 5% of my paycheck to play, and that's what I did. And I, to her surprise and to my surprise, I started winning, and now she's my biggest fan.
How soon after you began playing in tournaments with $25 entry fees did you know that you could compete one day with the heavyweights?
Oh, that was my ultimate dream, Bill. I wanted to go to the World Series of Poker, especially playing in the main event. So in May of 2007, I invested $225, and I competed against 187 other players at an Indian casino where I lived. And I beat every single of them that day. And I remember they brought out the $10,000, and they said, Jerry, you have a couple of choices. You either take the $10,000, forget about World Series, and go home and enjoy your $10,000, or let us use the $10,000 to buy the seat in Vegas, and when July comes, you will go there and play in the main event. And Bill, that was a very, very tough decision. I walked around in the casino for like a couple of hours. I didn't want to call my wife because I knew if I called her, she would say, take the money and come home. And so I didn't call her. I told them to go ahead and register me in for the seat, and they did that. And in July, I went to Vegas, and I played, and I 9 days later, I won the whole thing.
You are known for, among other things, for praying at the poker table, and you write that one of your prayers is, and I'm quoting now, Lord, let me survive this hand. Have you ever prayed for a specific card to show up?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. I don't think it's fair for me to pray to God to give me a specific card because I believe that God loves me just the same like he loves my opponent. And it wouldn't be fair for me to do that. But I truly believe that by praying, that gives me the strength and the wisdom and the courage to really play to the best of my ability.
Before you won millions of dollars at poker, you worked with at-risk children in Southern California as a psychologist. I'm wondering if you still do that sort of work, or has winning the World Series of Poker changed everything?
I don't do that anymore, Bill. The day that I won, my boss was very kind, and he called me and he said, "Jerry, don't even bother coming back." He was very kind, yeah. And I said, "Well, I still want to give my 2 weeks notice like everybody else." And he said, "No, don't worry about it. Just go." And so he was very gracious to do that. And when after I won, I saw a window of opportunity. I made a promise in front of ESPN cameras and also before God that I would donate 10% to three different charitable organizations, the Ronald McDonald House, which I am a big fan, and also the Make-A-Wish Foundation and Feed the Children, for one very specific reason. I used to be there. I used to be poor. I used to be hungry. I used to be sick. I used to be hopeless, just like those children. And I wanted to do that. So after the win, I donated the 10%, and I wanted to do more. And I, you know, so as I travel, I hosted charity events benefiting the Make-A-Wish and or the Ronald McDonald House, and I have personally raised over $800,000 since my win. And I will continue to do more. So I will continue to play, you know, to the best of my ability, and as long as my schedule permits me to do so. I love the game of poker, and I will continue to do it.
Jerry Yang with Mark Tabb wrote All In, From Refugee Camp to Poker Champ, published by Medallion, and he joined me from KFCF in Fresno, California. Jerry, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill. You have a wonderful day.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Nuance, offering Dragon 11 speech recognition software for creating documents and emails and surfing the web all by speaking at nuance.com. And Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals serving global 1,000 companies, oliverwyman.com. This is NPR.
Donkey named Napka went sailing through the air. She was a Russian promo stunt, and the folks who put her there were deaf to all her braying. But others heard her plea, and the Brits who read the Sun complained, and now that donkey's free. Oh, sports can be quite cruel, it's true, and sometimes they're a bore. But the parasailing donkey gonna fly no more. So praise the Tottenham soccer coach who opened up his door to that parasailing donkey, she'll fly. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, an ill-fated but sincere bid for the prestigious presidency of FIFA. But first, for 3 days in February 2011, Salisbury, Connecticut hosted the Ski Jumping and Nordic Combined Junior Olympics. Skiers and jumpers from all over the United States competed on Salisbury's Satre Hill. Some of the young athletes had been training for as long as a decade, but the town of Salisbury had been preparing for the event for more than 85 years. Only a Game's Karen Given had the story.
Watching ski jumping on TV is a thing of wonder, but nothing compares to the sights and sounds found a few steps below the takeoff ramp as athletes fly, literally fly, just above your head.
That was a little better.
Larry Stone has been watching jumpers fly for his entire life. He was inducted into the U.S. Ski Jumping Hall of Fame last year for his tenure as a national team coach and his contributions to the sport of women's jumping. He's retired now, but when he was only 8, Stoney, as the locals call him, got his ski jumping start right here in Salisbury, a town of less than 4,000 in the far northwest corner of Connecticut.
When I grew up in the 50s here, there were probably 8, maybe 9 jumps in town. And we all even had them in our backyards. We'd make them on little hillsides, and it was, you know, you just grew up here doing it like kids play baseball anywhere else.
Stone and his neighbors competed against kids from places like Norfolk, Bear Mountain, White Plains, and Rosendale, New York. Back in the 50s, Stone says, ski jumping was a normal part of small-town culture in New England. But somewhere along the way, that culture was lost.
All those towns that I was talking about, they don't have jumps anymore. Very few of them do. There used to be dozens of them, and now there's just a handful.
Recently, the residents of Salisbury were faced with a choice: invest more than $700,000 into building a new ski jump tower, or risk becoming one of the dozens of New England towns for which ski jumping is a thing of the past.
My name is Willie Hallahan, and I am one of the 19 directors of Salisbury Winter Sports Association.
The Salisbury Winter Sports Association, or SWASA, owns Satree Hills Ski Jump and operates jumping and skiing programs for kids in town. And you heard right, SWASA has 19 directors, all of whom eventually got behind the idea of building a new tower. If they built it, the Junior Olympics promised to come to town, bringing a national event to Salisbury for the first time since 1952. If they didn't, well, Hallahan says, nobody liked what would happen then.
We had an old wooden tower that has been in existence for decades. It was basically 26 pairs of telephone poles connected by that ramp, that in-run that the skiers come down. And it had gotten old, it had gotten rickety. We wouldn't let more than 3 jumpers up at the top at the same time because it would sway in the wind, just like the Empire State Building, but not as strong.
Ski jumping came to Salisbury in the 1920s with the arrival of a Norwegian immigrant, John Satree. Back home, Satree had been a world-class Nordic skier. In 1926, he decided to show Salisbury what the sport was all about.
One day he skied off the edge of a barn roof, and everybody was so enthralled that the next thing you know, they built a ski jump, a rudimentary one, but basically have been ski jumping ever since.
Every Christmas break, SWASA holds a clinic to teach a couple dozen local kids to jump, starting out on a 20-meter hill hidden in the woods. Hallahan understands why there aren't more. After all, despite the countless hours he's put into Salisbury's jumps, he's never been inclined to ski off one of them.
Never. and I think if you walk to the top of the hill, you may decide you wouldn't want to either. It's terrifying up there. The hill itself is 250 feet high, and the tower is another 70 feet above that. So when you're at the top of the tower, you're over 300 feet off the ground. It's a great view, but the notion of going down is just terrifying, too terrifying to contemplate for me.
Digby Brown is in charge of making sure everyone stays safe during today's Junior Olympic practice jumps. He grew up jumping in another New England town, Keene, New Hampshire. But he is another of the 19 SWASA directors who have never jumped off Satree Hill.
That doesn't make any difference. It's a people thing, you know.
Since World War II, not much has changed in the way SWASA prepares the hill for competitions. Sure, the organization now relies on snowmaking equipment during dry years, but the snow must still be set in place and grooves cut into the track by hand. Brown says when it's time to pack the tower, dozens of townsfolk pitch in to do their part. This year, the job was scheduled for one of the coldest nights of the year.
Yeah, right, that's right. It was the coldest night, I guess. It was about 6 or something. Plus the wind. Blew about 40, 50 miles an hour, they say it after. But anyway, we're up there, just having fun. Come on.
The thing about warming up with an extra large cup of peppermint tea at a coffee house in Salisbury while waiting for the parade of athletes to begin is that it's easy to strike up a conversation with a person at the table next to you. And the person at the table next to me is, you guessed it, another one of the 19 directors of the Salisbury Winter Sports Association. Lisa Shebley says that when building a new tower and hosting the Junior Olympics was first proposed, everyone was worried that raising the $700,000, which later grew to $850,000, wouldn't be possible.
We all said that. But somehow, this little dream, because jumping is a dream anyway. I mean, it's boys and girls are flying in the air. That's not supposed to happen. So for there to be this fundraising monstrosity of a job, it sort of goes with ski jumping somehow, you know?
Nick Moore lives in the nearby town of Sharon and is volunteering this week in the ticket booth. Though this is Salisbury's first Junior Olympics, the town holds a regional event every year. And every year, Moore says, the jumps, as the competition is called, bring a sense of wonder.
It's almost like Brigadoon, that you don't even notice that the ski jump is in town until you put the snow on it. It's dark and brown against the hillside, and people come out of the woodwork to pack the tower, to help volunteer, to do all the little things you need to do, and it happens. It's magic.
A lone drummer leads the 53 junior Olympians through the center of downtown, past the Academy building, currently hosting a photo exhibit celebrating Salisbury's 85 years of ski jumping, and past a large donation meter with the line hovering at just under $700,000. The parade stops at the steps of the library, said to be the oldest publicly funded free library in the country, where the young Olympians are greeted by music befitting a place where time stands still. Nina Lucy, a 16-year-old jumper from Lake Placid, carried the Olympic flame, just a tiki torch lit by a Bic lighter. She's visited Salisbury many times for the annual jumps, and she might be the only one who misses the old tower.
It's kind of sad. I mean, it's not the same old rickety tower as it used to be. That part of it is a little bit sad that it's gone, but the new tower and the new hill are simply amazing, and it's now really one of the best in the country, and everyone's lucky to be able to be jumping here.
Let the games begin! And the cauldron.
It takes a while, but eventually the cauldron is lit. Volunteers and jumpers head off to a spaghetti dinner, and Roy Sherwood, a 78-year-old lifelong resident of Salisbury, agrees to one last interview.
I've been very fortunate to be one of the better ones that come out of this town. Or the best. I have to blow my own horn once in a while.
Sherwood represented the U.S. in ski jumping at the 1956 Winter Olympics in Italy. He encourages new athletes to try ski jumping, but says today's kids are too lazy to climb Satre Hill's 300 stairs. They'd rather go downhill skiing, where they can take the lift. But with the new tower, Sherwood has found new hope for his town and for his sport.
That's a great town, and all it can do is get greater. Oh, I'm so glad. I'm so glad I was born in Salisbury, Connecticut.
For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
December, out in Thousand Oaks, 1,000 trumpets blared. If any other stuff transpired, probably no one cared. For Tiger Woods, the man about whom golfers long have dreamed, prevailed and won a tournament, and thus he was redeemed. Redeemed may seem a bit extreme, but only to those clods who fail to see that sports is not just money, scores, and odds. No, sports, if you're a winner, is salvation, without doubt. You lose, and then you win again. It needn't be a rout. Our Tiger needed one last putt to drop out on 18, and drop it did, and all that had been soiled was then washed clean. You lose and then you win again. You fall and then you rise. And those who have believed in you lift up their weary eyes and praise your perseverance. And their choirs sing your praise, the choirs of the labels you endorsed in better days. And once again you rise to claim the throne atop the heap of lesser fellows playing golf. And though the climb was steep, that only makes redemption sweeter when it finally comes. And hark, those trumpets that I mentioned have been joined by drums. It wasn't quite the Open, was it? Nor was it the Masters. No, just the Chevron Challenge. But it banished the disasters that had piled up since Tiger crashed his car and lost his wife, she having found that he'd been leading quite a different life from what she, mother of his children, might have felt was right. But all of that is in the past, for as of that bright night, redemption has been Tiger's, and the sport of golf as well ascends like helium balloons from that persistent hell where it had languished 2 long years while Tiger could not win. Those days of darkness now have passed, and multitudes begin to once again rejoice, for bad as all their prospects seemed, the times are joyous once again, now Tiger is redeemed. When asked how women's soccer should be promoted, FIFA President Sepp Blatter, the head of the sport's governing body, suggested, quote, tighter shorts. Homosexuality is illegal in Qatar, the site of the 2022 World Cup, and so Mr. Blatter said gays and lesbians attending the festivities should, quote, refrain from any sexual activity. In early 2011, Mr. Blatter was campaigning for his fourth term as president of FIFA. Grant Wall, who writes about soccer for Sports Illustrated and SI.com, announced his candidacy as well. Mr. Wall's campaign on the streets of New York sounded like this.
Hi, I'm Grant Wall. I'm running for FIFA president.
You're running for who?
FIFA president. You know what FIFA is?
No. What is FIFA?
It's the world governing body of soccer, and I want to run the whole thing.
Congratulations.
I appreciate your support.
I wish you good luck.
Thank you.
I spoke with Grant Wall in February of 2011, at which time I observed that the woman to whom he introduced himself sounded very supportive of his candidacy. But I asked him if she could help him win.
Well, that's the problem. It was wonderful talking with ordinary folks on the street, some of whom, like her, had no idea what FIFA actually is. Unfortunately, the ordinary folks can't vote for FIFA president. Mm. The election is going to be June 1st, and Sepp Blatter, who's been there for 13 years, is running for his fourth term, so far unopposed. He ran unopposed last time. So that's why I announced my candidacy. I want to feel like I represent the world soccer fans, but the actual election will be one vote per national soccer federation that's a member of FIFA.
Well, okay, I understand that you've entered this race for the most high-minded of reasons, Grant, but I'm going to accuse you of negative campaigning. You're coming out with slogans like Stop the Bladder Infection.
That's low-hanging fruit, I have to admit. But that's the amazing thing, is that FIFA is so screwed up at this point that it's really easy to campaign against them. It's really like shooting fish in a barrel. Sepp Blatter, the guy who runs FIFA, has come out against instant replay. He's come out against goal line technology so that we could just know if the ball crosses the line. Even corruption has been a problem in FIFA. Two of the voters for the World Cup in December were suspended and couldn't vote because they were caught trying to sell their votes. And Blatter has presided over all of this. One of my campaign promises is to go WikiLeaks on FIFA. And once I'm president, I'll release all the internal documents to the public.
Do you sense that Sepp Blatter is running scared?
No. Probably not. I think it's possible he is completely unaware of my candidacy.
Well, not after this show goes on the air, by golly.
But, you know, that's okay. You know, I think it's kind of good, though, even if we can have some fun with this, to kind of put a spotlight on FIFA and the fact that there's some real issues there and things that probably should change. And it'd be great if somebody else decided to run against Blatter as well.
All right. Now, I understand that you don't even get to vote for yourself because of the way FIFA works. But if you did win, what would be your agenda for change within FIFA? What would you do first week in office?
Well, one of the things I would do is make sure all the internal documents from FIFA were made public so we could take a look at what really goes on there. This is an organization that has never had its Salt Lake City moment like the IOC did with the corruption involved in that Olympic bid. But also, too, it's a very male-dominated organization at FIFA, and the all-powerful 24-man executive committee is exactly that. It's all men. So the first thing I would do is appoint a female general secretary, which is the most powerful appointed position at FIFA. And also, there's just some basic things about the game itself, whether it's instant replay for balls that are on the goal line to make sure they're in or out. I think it's the dumbest thing ever that players get yellow cards after they score a goal for removing their jersey to celebrate. It's the same punishment that a Dutch player got for karate kicking one of the Spanish players in the chest during the World Cup final. It doesn't seem like quite the same thing.
Well, you've convinced me, Grant. You've got my vote. But, oh, wait a minute. I don't have a vote either.
Exactly. So, you know, right now what I've got to do is convince one federation from some country in this world to nominate me in writing by April 1st. Mm. And if that happens, I can actually take on Sepp Blatter in the FIFA presidential election.
And FIFA is very wide-ranging. I mean, it could be a tiny country somewhere, right?
It could be anything. It could be a tiny African country, something in Southeast Asia. It could even be the U.S., though they tend to support Blatter. That's a long story.
Grant Wall is only a game's choice for next president of FIFA, although my understanding is that he hasn't quit his day job with Sports Illustrated quite yet. Grant, thanks very much. Thank you for speaking with me.
Thanks, Bill.
Grant Wall ended his candidacy on May 4th, 2011. He was unable to persuade any of FIFA's 208 national federations to nominate him. On June 1st, 2011, in Zurich, 203 delegates from FIFA nations voted 186-17 to keep Sepp Blatter in power for another 4 years. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view our photo galleries or learn more about this week's music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word this week comes from Gingerbread Trailer Park contestant Cresta Schaefer.
Honestly, there was no drinking involved. We just have messed up minds.
Oh, sure thing, Cresta. Sure thing. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org. And the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for improving education and enrichment for children both in and out of school at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.